Hey, what's up, guys? This is Lucas Burnley. You are listening to the Edge and Flow podcast. I'm here with my co-host TJ Schwartz, and we're going to start recording because we've just been talking. How's it going, TJ?
Going really well. Really, really
Nice.
well.
Nice.
Yeah. Making knives and getting ready for an upcoming show because we don't do a lot of shows. And this is one of my favorites. And this is Blade Show West. Are you going to be there?
I am not going to be there.
Still time.
Yeah, I'm bummed, man. But I don't want to talk about my toxic relationship with shows. I want to talk about your very positive relationship with shows because your timelines are good and you can like do them. You know, like, oh, this fits into our production schedule.
Not always,
Not yeah, there's no way that it happens all the time. I will say, like, on our side, like, we're definitely feeling like shows are becoming more feasible, but I'm still kind of hesitant. Dude, there's so many variables.
Well, part of the kicker is how early you have to agree to them, especially the big
Exactly.
ones. It's like, oh, 12 months out, I got to project. Is this going to be a good position for me? Yeah, it's a little tricky.
That's a really tricky one. Right now, is this the only show that you are like doing annually?
Yeah, this is the one show we just consistently have done ever since it was in Utah. We didn't we you and I attended the first one. What was it, 20 2001 or 2021
No,
or
20, probably 2022.
yeah, so we attended one and then we've actually exhibited every one since. So it's been really good.
And I mean, it makes perfect sense for you. It's a driving show. It really is a nice like vibe, but it's a mellow, it's like a still a pretty mellow show overall. In an area that has, I think, a lot of potential to be a good show location. But it hasn't, it's not like a hypey show yet. Right? Is it, has that changed at all?
No, I don't think it. I've said it a lot about this show. It for a Blade show, it's probably the most unique because it sounds like I can't say it certainly because I haven't been to Blade Texas yet. But Blade Texas and Blade Atlanta sound like they have similarities, in terms of the demographic and what's being sold there and stuff. To me, it just feels like when I go to Blade West, there's Utah folks in there, which are very hunting outdoorsy, and you just have a different vibe a little bit in that regard. So,
It feels a little more like an outdoor show.
yeah,
And less
exactly.
like Comic-Con,
Yes.
right? Like it feels a little less like hypey convention,
Yeah.
which on our side is like that's what we really look for. Like we want that kind of like, I don't know, like super nerdy anticipation and like fun, which guaranteed at the Salt Lake show like exists in small pockets, but that show just like overall vibe is still like it feels really grounded as a show. Like for instance, does anybody sleep outside the Salt Lake show? Do you know?
I don't know about sleep. It's definitely less of a line situation than the others. I think it is more just like gun and knife type buyers that just,
That are coming in,
yeah, that
right?
it feels like a lot of the people walking around, unless they're other makers or something, are a little bit more casual than the other shows.
Well, this is a great point too. Like if we look at this show from the like a collector side, for years I've said that new collectors, like one of the best things they can do is like find newer makers or newer shows. Because what happens is like you go to Atlanta and you're going to get a piece from, you know, any given maker that has demand. You are in the highest demand like space possible. It's hard to get airtime. It's hard to sit with someone and actually talk with them. Sometimes it's hard to get up to a table and actually like just check things out. Whereas if you as a collector can, you know, say like, all right, I'm gonna add this one show, you're gonna get a little more face time, a little more table time. and a little less like competition and pressure going into the room.
Yeah.
Right.
For sure. Yeah.
Which I think is super valuable.
Yeah, it is. And yeah, it's been my favorite show for a while, and I'm excited to go back, and we're getting our knives produced and ready for it. And it's feeling pretty comfortable. It doesn't seem like we're white knuckling it because I don't know. We just,
cause you're not.
Yeah, well, and it's not the kind of show where you're bringing hundreds of knives or something, you know. We're not in that position. The show's not in that position. It's a reasonable amount of knives, quite a few, and but nothing too crazy. So it's not a super heavy lift.
Well, and the fact we put so much pressure on ourselves because, I mean, the fact of like doing like a Blade Show Atlanta, it's like nuts and bolts. It's expensive to do.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's time, right? Like it's a long show to do. So, you know, like, all right, I got 3 days of show. Then you got a day or two of travel on either side. And you like, for us, I'm always like, I don't know if it's like a people pleasing thing or what, but I want like our customers to have a really good experience, and mm-hmm. I want to like bring like top level work, and I want to bring a lot of it, dude. And sometimes it's just fun to be a knife maker and be like, I made some knives. I'm going to the show. I'm going to put them out and I'm going to like hang out and talk. That I think probably in certain ways is almost more valuable than really hammering it. So you get to do that, dude, and you get to drive, which is like one of my favorite things in the world to do, is just drive to a knife show.
Yeah.
Right. Are you going solo? Who are you taking with you?
So it's looking like Steven's going to come down with us, who's one of our employees. He does all Cerakote and sheath making, and he's doing the sharpening now too. And he hasn't been to a knife show yet, so he's going to come down. And then my brother-in-law, Ronnie, who does our surface grinding, he's probably going to come down again. He just likes, he's peripheral to the knife industry because he does all our surface grinding.
Right.
But he doesn't necessarily make knives or isn't involved in the industry. So he likes to, that's his touch point to kind of see what's going on.
And he's been to that show, right?
Yeah, he's been, this will be like his third one, I think. So,
dude, there's no way to replace that experience. Mm-hmm. For employees. So, you know, I took Levi to the PNWCI, and he came as like, he's going to film, but also like help me at the table. But the reality is like, dude, it's just a good time. we eat well, you know, we usually have some drinks, like you spend a lot of time talking with nice people. Mm-hmm. And so I think like, I need to figure out how to get Isaiah to a show. It's the same thing. Cause it's like, dude, you put in all this work, but then you don't really see the final result. And like for Isaiah right now, it's like, he's all shop, right? So he's like, role is studio assistant, but dude, he's finishing parts. He's like, you know, he'll run the machine. Like he's all over the place. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
He just recently got to see kind of a full run of Kihoku's, like last step, go out the door.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see like the effect that had, oh man, like this is sick.
Yeah.
The show is the next extension of that. And it's like, if you really want employees to care, like we care, that's the thing that they have to see. Like they have to see someone get the knife and be like freaking out over it. And like looking at all the small details that you've been like, dude, we can't miss this. Like, this is not a small detail. Like, this is why it matters.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a huge value even for me because we've done so many, you know, internet sales and stuff.
Yeah.
But when you see someone, part of it is like you see someone pick up a knife in a sheath or pick up something.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can learn quite a bit because it's like, oh, when they went to put it in the sheath, they did this.
Yep.
Why is it that five people in a row did that weird thing? And it's like, it makes you think about the design because, you know, I think quality design doesn't require too much thought. It's like if you're something ergonomic, like let's say it's a flipper tab.
Yeah.
It's like, well, seven people in a row struggled to flip it and then figured it out. It's like, I watched them do it. They wouldn't have emailed me and said like, I struggled three times and then figured it out. They wouldn't say that. But now you know, like, oh, people are slipping off that flipper tab, it seems like. And
dude, it's intuitive design. People will ask me, like, hey, like, Like, it's not like in my mind, I'm not an engineer. I'm not engineering this really. It's like, I make it look the way I see it in my brain that I think it should work. And like, I'm not doing like studies on ergonomics. It's just like, I have a medium sized hand. I make it, does it fit my hand, someone bigger, someone smaller, whatever it is. But then you're 100% right. You go to the show and you watch someone like struggle with a Kydex sheath and you forget, dude, I've put 1,000 knives or who knows how many knives in and out of Kydex. I know exactly how they function, how much tension. Mm-hmm. I know what to do if it's too tight. Mm-hmm. Average, you know, collector. Folder collector picks up a fixed blade in Kydex. If they can't put it in and out of the sheath easily, that's on you, not on them.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like that right there is feedback that is so valuable.
Yeah. Yeah. There's so much to be gathered just seeing people's reaction to what do they gravitate to, you know, because on the internet, you can look at analytics, what are they clicking on or whatever it is. But it's different when you have an assortment on the table and it's like, wow, they really go for that micarta, man. They really like
that one piece, that's weird. Like I wouldn't have figured that. Yeah. This brown is going to get so many eyes. I feel like there's a good kind of lesson there, which for us has carried through into the production side. Right. Which is like, I always like as a custom maker, I can build anything I want. Like I can build something super weird, post it. And I'm going to find one of my collectors who loves it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you're doing a show, you see that in real time, but you're going to see what the mass of people are attracted to.
Yeah.
Okay. If you take that by extension into a production environment and you put that knife on an end cap at Dick's Sporting Goods, it's the same exact thing.
Yeah.
And so I think if you can like put yourself in that headspace, if that is a very valuable tool, it's just like some of this stuff we run in our heads or like we're making, it's almost like you're working in a vacuum.
Yeah.
And I think that doing shows, especially at this point where I would be curious to know of working knife makers, how many makers are doing shows versus online sales only.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is the kind of stuff I always wish we had like some kind of like industry organization, but we're so small. Cause yeah. I would like to know a few things, right? Like I would love to know salary ranges for custom makers and small manufacturers,
like a glass door for
like a glass the knife door.
Industry.
Totally. Right. Like, because it's hard, man. Like when I was a kid, I didn't have any concept of like the financial reality of knife making.
Yeah.
I started when it didn't matter to me. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I would like that. And then I would like some metrics just around that. Like, okay, in the United States, there's X amount of working makers of those makers. They go to these shows. Just be like, I just want to know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Big data.
Yeah. Big data.
That would be very interesting, I think.
Right.
And that frustrates me sometimes because I have a business advisor that has tons of experience in looking at like a profit and loss statement, looking at all these traditional documents that regard to the like business financials. And he's asking like, okay, so gross profit margin, net profit margin, like he's asking like, what's kind of a traditional, you know, gross or net profit margin in the industry? It's like, nobody knows. Honestly, people that own their own companies, probably a lot of them don't even know what that is. You know,
most of us are not like numbers driven.
Yeah.
Right. I can pull it up. I can get you an answer, but it's not first 10 rows of data in my mind.
Well, and if you were to say Google, like what is the typical gross profit for a restaurant?
Right.
You're going to find big data.
Big data. Yeah.
Easily.
Yeah.
And you're going to have like a set of targets. You're going to say, okay, if I have this gross margin, I'm in the top 10%. Or if I have this gross margin, like 90% of those restaurants fail. You know what I mean? And you can gather that. Whereas in the knife industry, it's like, I don't know. You know, it's.
Dude, I wonder if people like, My original thought, this is a tangent in my brain right now, which is you and I are actually poised to probably figure some of that out as much as anybody in the industry, right? Because of our relationships with manufacturers, but then mm-hmm. also at different scales, full, huge, huge mass market manufacturers down to mid-level or like micro manufacturing down to custom. Like mm-hmm. you and I could probably have, we have some areas that we could go, but I wonder if someone came to me and was like, dude, I want to make a black book. I don't need, we're not going to put names, but we are going to put data.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Where you're like, okay, what did your company, what did you do revenue last year? What were your profit margins? How many models did you sell? Whatever it is, right? Where else did you make money? What did you invest? Mm-hmm. Like, what's your debt? Like that kind of stuff. If you could just look at this and be like, here's 50 businesses. Here's what they're running. And you can be like, I'm doing good. I'm doing not good. It's not, people always say like run your own race. And I fully agree with that. But I also think there's a point where we need, like, you need like the tribal knowledge just as a baseline sometimes. Yeah.
Well, and knowing a bell curve on the statistics that matter is, it's not about the comparison about, oh, am I doing better than 50% of these people? Am I above average?
Exactly.
It's more about there's indicators for success in the long term. And it's like, it's kind of like if you knew your resting heart rate or your cholesterol or whatever, that means absolutely nothing if you're not comparing it to some curve.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's the same kind of thing. It's like, well, it looks like, you know, this kind of gross margin scenario is not sustainable because almost no one is able to operate at that level. Well, you know what I mean?
I would say like jewelers. I wonder if jewelers, there's a better, dude, it's hard because we don't have that many jobs in the, so you could like baseline, right? You could look at it and be like, well, if I was a knife maker in industry and I'm a knife maker on my own, here's the difference. Well, if I was a knife maker in industry, I'd be getting this insurance package and I'd be getting this salary. Dude, can't do that. A welder can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like you can be like, dude, I'm going to fix, you know, farm equipment and just have my welder and my little fab shop. If I go work for X company, here's what I get paid as, you know, building tanks or whatever it is, right? Like I work mm-hmm. building cell phone towers. I know what I got paid for that.
Pipelines or
and the thing is, I think a lot of us just whatever business we came out of or job we came out of, that's what we frame this against.
The baseline. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think I spent so much time early on modeling, right? But without true data, but seeing like I would go to shows and I would see Ernest, dude, right? I would see the lines at his table. I would see the lotteries they were having. I would see the amount of apparel people were wearing that said Emerson, right? I would see the knives in the magazines. And then I would see kind of like, oh man, like there's this collaboration piece or there's this, like that's sick. And I think a lot of those like early years, that was kind of like where I was like, you pick the makers that you see that are close to doing the thing that you where the place you would like to be.
Mm-hmm.
And you try to like model some, how they get there. Mm-hmm. Right. Like what are the steps mm-hmm. that they took? It was fun having Ernie on, 'cause we got to like dig into a little bit of that, where some of that was totally intuition based on my part or like just guessing.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, dude, I don't know. I guess maybe some of this too, like I'm at a point now where some of the steps moving forward are like less clear.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like inside the knife industry, there's only a few brands where I can look at what they're doing just kind of, and be like, oh yeah, like we're kind of seeing things the same way. Maybe you're ahead of where my business is at, or like, you know, I don't know, just kind of interesting. Like,
no, I have a, I'm a, in a similar position where I'm spinning my wheels a little bit, deciding on what the angle is for the next decade.
Yeah.
Because it's not playing small ball. Like what knife do we, what handle material, what, whatever. It's more like, what are we trying to turn into over time? And I struggle to answer that because, you know, you always look at someone like, oh, Benchmade. It's like, well, if you're going to want to do that, it's a very specific set of things that you have to do to become that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they're very reliant on distribution. That's kind of like their fame is like, they're the best distributed knife because you go to REI or whatever. They're always like at the forefront of these distributors. It's huge. And it's like, that takes a business model to achieve that. That's not any company could do that. Not like if a company went to REI and said, no, we want to have the glass case. It's like, well, have you set up your margins to be able to do that? You know what I mean? Do you have the way that you're, like I said, your gross margin, your net margin, like that matters fundamentally in terms of how you distribute your product.
Yeah.
And it's structural. It's not
And it's like, dude, when did that come into play? Right. Like, when did it go from less making Bally songs? And like, at what point did that, somebody knows that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, somebody knows enough about the company to look at it and be like, yeah, here's when they went like distribution model. Mm-hmm. Right. But looking at it externally, like, these are questions. You nailed it too, man, which is like, they're kind of the same questions as you would almost ask as a custom maker. So like, if you looked at me as a custom maker being like, what is the thing that I want to take to the next show? What techniques do I want to try? Or if you're, you know, one of the guys who is very mechanism minded, it's like, what's the next mechanism I'm making? It's just scaling from that. Mm-hmm. But it's less one product or a couple product focused, and it's more systems oriented.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's where, like, I'm really struggling now. And I look at it and I'm like, yeah, I'm not used to systems. I'm used to making a thing or some things, some creative concepts, but now organizing those in a way that's cohesive enough to move forward with purpose feels crazy to me.
Yeah. 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 And I think it's pretty important because I think if you want to be somewhere in 10 years with intention, you have to start laying foundations, and you can have success with just being reactive and like,
yeah, totally.
You're growing, but you're also just kind of doing what you've always done. That's always a possibility, and there's nothing wrong with that. But like I said, Benchmade didn't just accidentally become Benchmade. Montana Knife didn't accidentally become Montana Knife. That doesn't happen because they just put one foot in front of the other.
Yeah,
there was intentionality in the architecture of that
and
business.
Risk, dude, because at a point, you are taking a significant risk somewhere where you're like, oh God, this is all of our resources. This is the money that we have. If this doesn't work out, maybe it doesn't tank you, but it hurts.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Do you look at goals? Do you look at where you want to be or like what you want to be doing? Or do you look at what you don't want to be doing mm-hmm. or where you don't want to be? Do you ever, or is it a balance?
Oh, that's exactly, that's like my whole life right now. It's thinking about both of those things.
Yeah.
And looking at companies out there in the field and imagining where there could be a company that isn't. That's the other thing. It's not always about following another path, but, I think about that a lot because the way I see it is if you want to be where another company is in size or in the market space or in the way that they sell knives or in their, you know, quality to value area. I think for me, the way I approach that to follow that path is you don't look at what they have and try to replicate it. You think about what are the values and the ethos of what they have and you start applying that to the small decisions.
Yeah.
And then you'll naturally sort of bend in trajectory towards what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so what are those tenets, I guess you'd say, what are those like core, you know, critical developments early on that are going to affect decisions one after another. Yeah. And one of the examples is like, what margins are we, a simple one, really clear, that's really concrete, is like, if you're looking at Benchmade or you're looking at Montana Knife or one of these companies, it's like, what margins are we going to allocate to distribution?
Right.
If you're Benchmade, you're allocating a lot of margin to distribution. That means the product design and manufacturing has to play in that space that allows for that distribution to be paid for.
Yes.
And it's like that affects the design of the product.
Yep.
It affects the way you're going to scale the manufacturing and the way you're going to price your product.
Yep.
And which in turn affects how you're going to market it. You know what I mean? Because, and so if you're making a decision like, we want to be the company that you see when you walk into Cabela's, you got to start making decisions right now. And so I think a lot about that, because we're a little bit like a flag in the breeze right now, because we have this general idea that we're going to be like a direct to customer. And I like the direct to customer. I don't think we want to go with distribution in a macro sense. But you look at Montana, they're an interesting one because they're direct to customer. They don't do retail. But the way that they're getting exposure as opposed to the distribution is they're collaborating with influential brands and people.
Right.
And that costs money. Right.
Yep.
Inherent. And so there's like,
you're giving a cut somewhere. Okay. Hold on. My brain, I want to like do like four, see if I can like actually maintain where they were. One, the idea of modeling is you're absolutely right in the fact that like the goal is not to do what a company is doing or what a maker is doing. This falls into the understanding of the steps that maybe a company took to get to a point and then aligning them around your work, your values, your priorities, but seeing certain intentional steps. This is like a good analogy for like, you know, good artists borrow, great artists steal, where it's like the goal is like you end up with a company that's totally different, but the DNA that's there, you're like, okay, they did these steps. Like that to me is valuable. You see this with custom makers, where if you learn from a maker, there are guys whose work looks exactly like that maker's, or people who take the process and put it into their own visual aesthetic. Okay. Two, dude, I was in Dick's Sporting Goods and I overheard a conversation that they were running wiring for Benchmade's display case. So that is a great example. You are running, they did a drop down power supply, like what we would run for a machine, to light up a big beacon of Benchmade.
Yeah.
You walk into the store, dude, and it is freaking impressive. Like, it's like a lighthouse. Yeah. Like, you're like,
yeah,
all right, well, there's the center of the store as marked by the Benchmade obelisk. Dude, it's great.
Yeah. And a big part of that, in my understanding, is they do a thing called map pricing.
Right.
So if I sell a knife to a Blade HQ or any kind of retailer, the general agreement, the like standard contract, is like they can sell it for whatever they want. Right.
Right.
So I tell them what the MSRP is. I sell it to them for X amount. They can go say, well, we're going to run a 10% discount. We're going to undercut.
Yeah, we're going to run a sale. We're going to run. Yeah. We only care if we make 10% margin on it in general.
Yeah.
So MAP is minimum advertised price. Okay. So for you guys that like have never heard of this, the idea, if you ever get a coupon that is like, respond to this email or put the item in your cart and you will see the price, that is a workaround for MAP, because they can't tell you how much the product, they can't advertise it. So Benchmade protects their MAP. That's where you're going with this, right?
Yeah. So like if you're Benchmade, I'm going to use round numbers. I'm not saying these are accurate. If you're Benchmade and you want these retailers to have a large margin, and that's what motivates them to do all this extra work and put you at the forefront, you would give them the large margin. So you'd have a high MSRP, offer the huge margin relative to other companies to Cabela's.
Yep.
But if you don't have MAP pricing in place, then Cabela's, Bass Pro, and Dick's Sporting Goods, they're all going to start to compete with each other. And that large margin you're trying to give them is going to get competed away.
Well, and then so, here's now this is something that really ties into this. So the big stores can compete, but they also have margins. Now they could make it a loss leader, but mm-hmm. one of the things they're also looking at is a dude living in his mom's basement who loves knives, who's a dealer. This is not targeting anyone. If this is you, I'm mm-hmm. sorry. And selling it at 10%.
Yeah.
Because they have no overhead.
Yes. Yeah.
And that right there is like, there are brands that won't sell if you don't have brick and mortar, right? There are mm-hmm. brands that will sell to you if you're an online retailer, but you have to maintain MAP. Yep. And this is a great example of something that, did they protect that from the beginning? Was there a hard lesson learned? Was there a decision at a point to can you reel it back in?
It was about 2015 when they went to MAP.
Ooh. So you know that's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. I've got a story around that, which actually maybe we could get into. But yeah, so basically if they enforce the MAP, all the retailers that get a Benchmade, they have the security of knowing that they can sell it for that high margin and somebody's not undercutting them around the block because Benchmade is telling them they can't.
Right.
So then inherently, if you're at a high margin position with MAP enforcement, if they sell a Benchmade, they're going to make more money on that knife than any other knife they have because all the other ones are subject to competition from the other retailers.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do if you're a retailer?
Yeah.
You're going to sell as many Benchmades as you can.
Yeah. You got great margins. I think that also, I mean, Benchmade is pretty consistent. I mean, there are companies that are not consistent in their sales, in their support of distribution. Mm-hmm. You know, I would imagine Benchmade probably is pretty dialed. This is tangent number two, I think, which is, I don't know how often I hear someone say like, oh, Benchmade's overpriced, Benchmade's expensive. It's usually in a conversation where Benchmade is coming up as this insanely dominant force. And this is something that with makers and human nature is super confusing to me. We are talking about how effective they are, how strong in the market, how visible they are. And people's brain go, well, it's too expensive. Well, no, we can make the argument that it's not because they're in this position. It's actually not too expensive. The flip side is like, you know, it's a sick price for a product is zero. Okay. Dude, if you have a product that is $0, you're going to sell so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the point. Like you don't want to do that. Right.
Yeah.
As makers, we need to really look at the concept of value as, I think, multiple layers of actual manufacturing costs, market value, like how people interact with that product. What do you want it to provide for your life? But just looking at something and being like, it's overpriced, you know, it's not, man, because if something is a price that you don't like, it means it's not for you.
Yeah.
That's certainly all it means.
Mm-hmm.
Too expensive or too inexpensive. And I think if people look at, usually it comes up when things are too expensive, but the reality is most of us have some category where a thing is too cheap for you.
Yeah.
No, that's not the quality I want.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the point where I did that with groceries. I like stopped buying Surefire. I don't have to do that. Mm-hmm. Right. We guaranteed do it with tools.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. There's price itself can indicate quality and a low price, even if it like take three products that are identical and price them all differently.
Yep.
The type of person that doesn't like buying cheap stuff is not going to buy the cheapest one, even though it's the same.
If you have three things of equal quality,
but in
the market, if you are not knowledgeable in specifics, price is the first indicator.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of information in a price,
and that can be false, right? Like if you look at luxury, like the luxury market and like luxury goods, an argument could be made like, well, yeah, Birkenbag's not worth 60 grand, but why is because people are looking at it from the manufacturing standpoint. If you don't understand the price point, it's not for you.
Right? It's people are buying it for other reasons.
Yeah,
certainly.
So, and
little side story, speaking of that map thing. So you guys are familiar with Mastrop. You know Mastrop.
Oh, yeah.
So their whole business model was they started out with it was like cameras and digital stuff on this forum. And they're like, what if reach out to Canon, who makes cameras. Ask them what their minimum order quantity is. And for like a wholesale deal. And let's say they're like, oh, it's 100 cameras is the buy-in. So on this forum, they're like, what if we got together and made like this little website where we all sign up and put our information in and pool our money and do a group buy and buy those 100 cameras. We get 100 of us. We each get a camera and we say, take the wholesale price and we add like 5%. So we can run the website off of a tiny margin because a retailer has to buy and have the risk of having the inventory and then sell. So they got to cover their risk. If you do a group buy, there is no risk because if you don't get 100 people, then you just don't order them. And so they made a whole website out of this where you would go on there and you would see all the products from all, I mean, we're talking any kind of product.
Everybody. I remember around Beats headphones and so like anything kind of but it was tech kind of started, right?
It was founded in like headphones and audio equipment.
Yeah, it was like audio equipment and stuff.
Yeah, keyboards and stuff.
Yep.
And so you go on there and you say, I want that. And the price is nuts. They list a price because they're taking the wholesale price. They're adding like 5%. So you sign up and it may be 60 days before you even get it because you have to wait for the group buy. It's kind of like a little bit of a Kickstarter kind of feel to it.
Yep.
So anyway,
what year was this? Are they still around?
They are. They renamed to Drop.
Renamed to Drop. Okay.
Yeah.
And I remember that
really well, actually.
Was Mastrop the first one to do that model?
I've not seen someone do it like that.
I remember seeing them first. And it was funny because they got into the knife industry and they were actually like a huge force inside the industry for X number of years. When did that start though?
So what happened was they were selling knives because it's just another category. They're just like, we'll just do group buys on knives. We'll, get these people together. And then they got enough resources where they started to want to do in-house products to kind of augment.
I remember that. Yeah.
And so they were selling, I don't know when they started selling knives, but they were selling Benchmade. They were selling HK, Heckler & Koch and all this stuff. Ooh, I might've been wrong earlier. Let me add this. So HK, which was Benchmade's gun partner, Heckler & Koch, they had the HK version. This is what it was. So I don't remember. I don't know when Benchmade started doing map pricing.
Yeah.
It would have been a longer ago than I thought. But HK, they didn't do the map pricing on.
Oh.
And so what Mastrop was doing is they can't buy Benchmades through this group purchase thing because it violates map pricing because that like 5% margin is in violation. But they could do it with the HKs. What happened in 2015 or 16 is Benchmade killed the HK deal. So Mastrop lost the ability to have a Benchmade product on that website because that was the one spot
that
where
was
they could do
that
it.
That was like the
so backdoor. They reached out to us and myself and Millet, and that's where we ended up with the Perpetua, was because the killing of HK left that pocket where they couldn't get a Benchmade. So they're like, we'll just make something in-house, quote unquote in-house, and hire an OEM. And that's when Mastrop came about. So talking to them is how I got so much information about all the map
like
stuff
the map.
And
yeah,
all that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So,
that's super interesting. For you guys listening, do yourself a favor and try and find one of those Mastrop Perpetuas. One, it's a sick design. The price was insane. You guys had that price point so low. It's an awesome knife. And I don't really like see them pop up.
Yeah.
Do you remember like total numbers? Do you know how many got made?
In the low couple thousand range,
that is, but
like
that's
that.
Enough.
Yeah.
Go find a Perpetua. They're sick.
Yeah. It's just a little funny little thing right there that happened. But yeah, they partnered with Wii Knife as an OEM,
Right.
not for that knife, but they them
But after that,
and
that's what I remember primarily was like at a point, it was mostly I remember like Ferrum Forge
Ferrum Forge
stuff
was the OG.
was like the
Yeah.
OG, which I think is like Wii base kind of stuff, or you know, that it's pretty interesting.
So they exploded for a minute there. And what I understand is that basically, no matter how big the knives got from a management standpoint of that company, the tech was the interesting thing and the primary focus. And so they kind of just wrapped up the knife thing and went all tech, which just kind of the knife thing did seem like kind of interesting and kind of a
It
little bit
guaranteed it's
off
like
brand
anything
for
else.
them.
There was a couple people or a person on that team for a while that liked knives or EDC and pushed that initiative. Right? Because I remember who was the guy that we would always see at shows?
Jonas
Remember?
Heineman.
Jonas Hein. And he left the company, right? Okay. So I would guess that he probably had something to do with the knife side.
But yeah, that's a cool piece of knife industry history is the mass drop thing, because everyone was talking about them. I know all the companies were talking about them, because it was kind of scary for a minute there. They're like, this group buy thing, it's the price that they're going to be able to pull off. It's kind of what I was talking about earlier, which is like they had an architecture that was going to beat everyone on margins and on price. No one can beat them in a traditional model. And so that's like a classic example is it the way you design the business at the outset, how you're going to sell it, how you're going to distribute it, how are people going to hear about you, how are you going to pay for that? That matters a whole lot in
How are you
terms
going to
of,
protect it? Because long game, right? Long game, and this is something that I think you and I talk about a decent amount because we think we are both long-term thinkers in terms of relationships and value. The knife industry is really hard financially, it can be. And so we see it's really easy to make a short-term financial decision that like moves the needle now, but isn't a good long-term play, right? I think about it in terms of collaboration a lot of times. Like I see people, you're just psyched to have someone that wants to work with you. They might pay a good percentage. They're promising something, and you jump at that, and it's like wasted time, wasted resources, whatever, right? On something like Benchmade side, Mass Drop could have sold a lot of knives, but that would have guaranteed that would have damaged their relationship with their like key partners. Because it's like, what the heck, guys? Like you're selling these knives and these numbers and they're buying them here. What's the reason they're going to come through our doors? That's the kind of thing like you can't, it's pretty hard to like take that back, unwind it, right?
That retail margin that Benchmade has, that's their golden goose right there. And a deal like that just kills the golden goose. It's like all of a sudden then you'd have a race to the bottom across all your retailers, which would mean that the knife no longer becomes the best margin for the retailers, which means they're not going to push it that hard. It's like a domino effect. So yeah, it's an interesting thing. So I think a lot about that right now in our business, because how we manufacture and how we price fundamentally is not gonna it's gonna decide what we can and can't do. It's gonna set actual boundaries. So if we want to have a small gross margin, we want to have, like, let's say customer pays us $1 for a knife. If we want to spend as much as possible on the knife, we are going to be barred from doing distribution. We're going to be barred from paying large amounts of money for like influential help. And so it's like you're just counting on word of mouth at that point. And there's a bit of a risk and a slowness in that. I like that model, but it's a little bit sketchy feeling to not, do it the old fashioned way, which is like you save a bunch of money on the back end to go get the word out there. So I go back and forth. I think a lot about it for sure.
It's it is the size of the questions just keeps getting like bigger and more consequential. Like, man, I don't know. Another kind of like pop-up thought, which I don't know how this came from the mass drop thing is going to be a stretch. Dude, are we right now? So sales mechanism, sales platform, thinking about makers, thinking about options. I was thinking about this coming into the shop today. Are we in a golden era of ability to become a small company based on machinery and technology?
Certainly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Where my head was at with it is, I know where this came from. Kickstarter. Okay. So brought up Kickstarter, brought up Mass Drop. Dude, if you go on Kickstarter at any given time, there are five machines that are being released that as a small business, you can basically afford that would give you some kind of insane industrial capability.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So like you'll go on, you'll be like X tool. Okay. Sick. Now they have a laser cutter that'll cut like 10 mil steel, do engraving, do laser welding. And that machine is 12 grand. 12 grand may sound like a lot if you don't own a shop, but in the big picture of things, like that is short money.
Oh yeah. Manufacturing tools are becoming a consumer product, which is the trend.
Right.
It's insane.
I always like the term prosumer.
Prosumer, right? Yeah.
Where you're like the quality is good enough for professional, but at consumer or close to consumer pricing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have the Wazer water jet is an example of that.
Prime $10,000 water jet.
Yep. Whereas the next one up from there is like what, 70 or something?
So. You know what's interesting? We were just talking about this yesterday, is Omax makes a small form factor water jet. And Omax, like a lot of the big shops, like it's like professional. Like Wazer was like a Kickstarter water jet, but mm-hmm. it's Wazer. Omax is you go to your water jet company, or you know, whoever's doing water jet, they might be running an Omax.
Yeah, yeah.
They do a small form factor that's like 27 grand. And I've always wanted one because I want to own all the process all the time. But like just all this stuff, like it's a laser or it's a new printer or it's some type of new router or one that we really want to get is the new UV printer.
Mm-hmm.
Like this stuff is, these are things that like haven't been available, you know? And then this tying in, you made a really good point around like software. Dude, like 15 years ago or more to get into a CNC machine, like basically you were probably getting SolidWorks at like a $20,000 seat.
Well, SolidWorks and like MasterCam or Gibbs Cam or something. Yeah, it used to be that you were going to have to budget $20,000 to $30,000 if you're going to do it, you know, legally.
Legit.
You're going to have to budget like tens of thousands of dollars on software to be able to run most of these CNC mills and things.
Yep.
And so we talked about like the revolution of Fusion 360 and how that changed everything.
Yep.
Because none of this equipment that you're describing that is for manufacturing works without CAD. You can't run a laser without a design, right? You need to have a drawing. And so the CAD revolution, I think, in terms of Fusion making it accessible, especially the free version for students and all the stuff that they did, brilliant move. And I think it staged this because now we have like a generation of people that actually know CAD.
Yeah.
And as soon as you know CAD, if you've ever messed around, the first thing you want to do after you've got like the most basic set of skills is like, now I want to make this.
Yeah.
But you don't really think about running a CNC until you have your feet wet in CAD because you're like, wait a minute. I get it. I know how to design. It connects the dots for people. And 3D printers, I think, were a huge thing in connecting those dots for people because they're going into Fusion, designing a little widget or whatever, some cup holder, whatever. And now they're making it, and that like loop that they've created there is like it's seared into these makers' brains for the first time of like a computer design thing that is made by some sort of automation system.
Yeah.
And now it's proliferating into water jet, into laser, into, you know, like metal 3D printing.
Yeah.
And all it's
well, and all
crazy.
The skills are all interrelated, right? Like, dude, I don't know. Like the 3D printer thing is still like mind blowing to me. I've spent so many years just building things by hand that the ability to draw something and then physically create it out of nothing, basically, like some plastic, some fat fishing line, is nuts to me. Like, it's wild, dude. I mean, I was thinking, like, a lot of companies now have, like, there's proprietary software, right? But there's also access to all this learning around the proprietary software. You can go on YouTube and be like, I'm going to learn Lightburn, right? Or I'm going to go watch endless Fusion tutorials. Like, you can find, like, real Fusion tutorials on YouTube for any kind of, I mean, including knife making. Plug for your knife making course, which I keep recommending, which we don't talk about enough, which is, like, essentially, that's the way that I got functional in Fusion, was basically just following along the steps that you laid out, right?
Yeah.
It's repetitions. But dude, this stuff was not, what's the name of your CAD program? Your
designincad.com.
Designincad.com. Really good. I don't know, man. The stuff, it's like a, there's like a, I don't want to say ebb and flow, but it feels like over the last 20 years, you can kind of, like, in the time that I've been in, you like catch these little waves and it pulls you to the next like change in the industry, which
definitely
is
definitely a surfer.
Really, yeah. It was just like really fun though.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
totally. Like you get a little bit of a push and then you're like, all right, that I'm just on it for now. And then something else kicks in. And right now it does feel like learning things and bringing in process, adapting process, at least on my side, is like super interesting and also a trap in the other stuff that we're talking about, which is like, how do you lay out this like structured framework for like future growth? Cause I can't, like we say, I can't grow all the time. Right.
Yeah. And what I love about all this is you can now prototype a process.
You can prototype a process.
Because it used to be, you either laid out $1 million to just get started.
Yeah.
Because you needed the CNC mill, you needed the bevel grinder, you needed the water jet, you needed the laser. Yeah. You're in the millions.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Even now you're still there if you're going into full manufacturing.
Full manufacturing.
If you're trying to have 50 employees, like, yeah, you're going to lay out millions of dollars for equipment. But it used to be that was the only option. And so you either got an investor, did something crazy, you just had to be really ballsy and make a huge leap. And you're like, you're either a knife manufacturer or you're a custom maker. There's not an in between.
Yes.
And now you can, like in the garage when I had the machines in there, it's like, it felt like we were prototyping a process.
Yeah.
That's only possible if you can have those processes in a garage affordably.
Out of the gate. So right now, that's exactly how I feel. Shop 2 is a prototype shop.
Yeah.
That's it, man. I'm like, if I can make that shop run like a small production company, that lays the groundwork to scale the production company. 100% prototype.
Yep.
Also 100% in a home garage.
Yeah, exactly. And
nuts.
It's possible now. And I think people are taking advantage. I think it's really interesting. You got companies like Sencut Sen that are also feeding into this. Dude, and
that's what I mean. Like the access to things like is crazy. So this is the shift, right? Like I think for a while, the easy button was almost to go to the overseas OEMs.
Yeah.
And I would still say in a lot of ways, like that's still the, if you're like, I'm going to take $60,000 and I'm going to have a run of knives made. You can't do that probably on your own. And if you don't have the inclination to build things, it doesn't matter anyway. But I think the value proposition has changed as that market has become more and more saturated. I think the ability to do small batch production is starting to like pull back in. I see people like buying machines and like,
yeah,
I see small, like now I'm like, oh, you're going to learn to make a thing. You're going to learn to be a brand, but now you're financing a Haas.
Yep.
Not just doing a production run. And we see this. One of the things I love about our Facebook group, right? It's probably around 10,000 members, but like it's people who just love EDC, love knives. Mm-hmm. Like they really love it. And so out of that, we've seen a bunch of people basically create brands.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen the way that they do it over time. And that now I'm seeing another shift where it was like for a while, they were building a little brand and having stuff produced. Now it's like people are building a little brand, buying the machines, they're learning to produce.
Yeah.
And which so to me, it's an indicator.
I love it, dude. I think the fact that, because I show people, the people that aren't at all in the industry or anywhere in proximity, they see the machines and they think it's like some sort of science fiction thing. And I'm like, I have probably 25 contacts on my phone of people that own a CNC machine.
Yeah.
In their private life, like not even in an industrial way.
Yeah.
And it's like, for me, it's like, oh, I mean, it's, you know, you're going to go into landscaping, you buy an F-150. I mean, you know what I mean? But it's funny how that's happened, where it's like, yeah, you know, everybody's got a CNC like in their barn or something. It's just like normal.
It's kind of true, man.
Yeah.
It's really, I don't know. This is, it's a pretty interesting time. There's a lot of like, there's always a lot of moving parts. And there's, I guess for me, like there's probably always something that is interesting, because as things change, the focus changes, like something becomes more visible or something starts, you start to feel a shift. I don't know what the next shift is like for us. That's like right now, like, well, I don't have the 5-year plan. It's not clearly defined.
So here's what I can say, in my opinion, is that we are seeing everyone's prototyping processes. Maybe they don't identify it that way, but that is true. And out of this really wide, thin network of people making, people are going to do something different. And 10 years from now, people doing something different are going to be rivaling the Benchmades, the Buck Knives.
Sure.
Who is it going to be? Because it used to be, like I said, there just wasn't a lot of new companies that could just be ballsy enough or have the investor or whatever to just like go after Benchmade or go after these companies. But now you've got this just wide swath of everyone's able to prototype processes.
Yeah.
And it's just a natural part of capitalism, is like people are going to figure stuff out that wasn't figured out before, and they're going to grow, and there's going to be these companies that come out of it. And
Montana did that. I mean, and this is Montana, this is not in like an aggressive or competitive even way of like saying this, like you saying that, it's purely just that hunger motivates.
Yeah. Yeah.
And passion motivates. And so who is it? It's Andy Samberg, Connor For Real. Never stop, never stopping. That is like, the reality is like, if you're the big dog, right? Dude, you don't get to rest. It's funny, man. Like I worked in bars for a long time and I was a bouncer for years. And you think like in a certain way, you think like reasonably, like if you're like the big dude, like you don't get messed with. It's not true.
Yeah.
People take shots at the big dude. Like, I don't know how many people I've seen get rolled because they were like testing a big dude.
Yep. Yep.
Right. But it wasn't always the case. Right. Like sometimes that dude got rolled.
Yeah.
And so I think that like, if you're in pole position, you're just kind of like, you're the aspirational target or however, whether it's a positive aspiration and negative, whatever it is, it's like people can look at that and go, dude, I want that thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And one of the phrases I like is, it's windy on top. You know what I mean?
That's really good.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't have negative feelings to Benchmade. I keep mentioning that. Only
yeah. Or
because
any
they,
of them. Yeah.
They're the obelisk, the shining gem, you know, they're the
yep.
that's Benchmade. Obviously, they can hold the place as a metaphor for a type of company as well.
Yep.
Because you have, I mean, plus or minus, we're talking $100 million knife companies. There's a handful of them.
Yeah.
And Benchmade is a very notable one. And all these companies, they were all founded in a similar era, in like a 20-year window, they were all founded.
Or at least in the modern variation of what that company is.
Right. Well, even because you look at Kershaw,
yeah,
and Benchmade and Gerber's slightly prior, but what
Gerber is like old.
How old though? Like 60s?
Dude, Pete Gerber, that goes like way back.
Does it go further than that?
Yeah, that goes further back.
Okay, that's fair. But there's like there is a density though in the mid 20th century of foundings.
Yeah.
If you notice, there haven't been very many since.
Not big.
Yeah. Right? I think there might be another wave coming.
That's pretty interesting.
Because they established pole position and they held it.
Leatherman.
And
so Leatherman's same era. Leatherman, yeah. Same era.
Yeah.
So, right. And there's the big companies. I'm trying to think. I can't even like add really one.
Yeah.
It's like Chris Reeve is a large company, right? But it's the same era.
Basically, name a company that's like the big boy that was founded after 1990. And it's pretty tough.
You're right. Okay. And so you think there's another wave of that coming?
Yeah, simply because from, I don't know what was in the water from like 1960 to 1990. There was something in that period that resulted in a lot of these companies being born. What that was,
it's age, dude, guaranteed. It was like interest in an industry. So you have like, 60s, you have like the Lovelaces, and you have like interest in the US knife market. And of those guys, so there was some kind of boom in custom knives, probably the Guild. Of those guys, some of them left and started the big company. So like Chris Reeve would be a great example of that. You have a custom maker who's making knives and then, moves to the US, scales a company.
Yeah.
Right. A lot of those guys did. So maybe it's just that between the margins, generationally, that hasn't been the thing. But in there, you have Rick Hinderer, you have Ernest Emerson, you have companies that have popped up inside of that.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. It's like,
but yeah, there's like a fork though. There's layers here. And that's where it feels to me like, I don't know what was in the water in the 80s that caused all these companies to start. But if you look at what's happening now, it feels like this must lead to a proliferation of these new startups. And you have to assume like that they're eventually going to challenge the old guard.
How about this as a concept? At the point where those companies were founded or developed or scaled, to become that type of company based on the manufacturing, like technology that was available and the buy-in, like you had to become big.
Mm-hmm.
What if the reality is actually that at this point, you don't have to become as big. I was thinking about it in terms of like car manufacturers.
Yeah.
Like you don't have to become Ford necessarily to be a car company.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's a great point, dude. I didn't think about that. That might be what it is. Cause it's like, let's say there was $500 million worth of market cap that split up into five companies that started in the 80s. Now, let's say with the new companies, there's a similar amount, but it's now split up 50 ways.
Yeah.
That does sound like a realistic kind of explanation for that.
Kind of, right? Like, and you had to buy in and build up to a point where you could maintain your sales. And now, I don't know, like seeing the way that you're doing things, seeing the way that, I mean, at every level, because we have the same thing that the other like eras of knife making have. You have like a company that owns every process internally. You mm-hmm. have a company that outsources the majority of the process, but still owns it when it comes back in. And you have like full OEM or white label manufacturing. We have these at our scale. We have all of these, which are the models for all of the big companies. Mm-hmm. But you laid it out. Dude, you don't need $1 million worth of machinery to own every process.
Yeah.
Dude,
I think you're on it. I think that makes the most sense, is that we're just seeing a democratization, like a spreading out of angles here. So I guess it remains to be seen whether in a quote unquote competitive environment where there's way more players.
Yeah.
Does that mean it stays spread out, or does that mean the quality elevates and someone still comes out in the pole position?
I have to assume that it will still maintain. Mm-hmm. I have to assume in a version, because it would be crazy to be like, dude, there will never be a large knife company again. That's a weird thing to say.
Yeah.
Dude, like, I'm reading this right now. Okay. Uh-huh. This is, dude, it's what we do repeated over and over again. Okay. This is Creating Modern Capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If I was holding it up to the screen like a fool. How entrepreneurs, companies, and countries triumphed in three industrial revolutions. Dude, it's heavy. But mm-hmm. what you see is like the stuff that we're doing, like we're not in a vacuum. It just keeps happening. So that's my thought, is there will be a version of it, but it's still going to happen. Someone's going to make the next big company.
Yeah.
Who's it going to be?
Yeah, it's it's interesting, and I'm gonna have to think about that a lot more. Because
Is Montana poised to be the Montana? It's Montana right now.
Yeah, Montana. I think they are clearly a rocket ship. I mean, they're probably the fastest growing knife company in the history of knives. I honestly doubt any company.
Yeah, gut response, right? Unverified, but I would agree.
I mean,
and they're fully utilizing the resources that are available to all of us. Yeah. That's the thing.
I mean, they went from zero to tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
In 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
No, but I don't.
Yeah.
There's not even.
And
that
they're
many
they're like breaking ground on like a huge.
Yeah.
The thing is, they're building the framework to be a big company.
Mm-hmm.
So that right there, I mean, you just answered it, probably.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
'Cause nobody else is doing what they're doing. And once again, this is my favorite thing. Listen to where people tell you that something can't be done.
Yeah.
Okay. Listen to your gut. And when someone tells you like that doesn't work, that doesn't scale, listen to yourself and see if that tracks, because Montana is proving a lot of those conversations wrong. Props to them.
What if you went back to 2019 and you said, listen, you talk to all the knife company people, all the knife industry people, you said, here's my business plan.
Yep.
I'm going to start a knife company. We're going to sell fixed blades only.
Only to hunters.
We're going to be, our target is $25 million in 4 years.
And we're going to be a premium product.
And we're not going to sell folders. And they're going to be like about $300.
And we're not going to do knife shows.
And we're not going to sell to retailers either. People would be like, dude, you're,
oh, and we're going to do a drop model.
Yeah. It would seem impossible to look
to
at
some
it.
Some people,
but now in hindsight, it's like, well, that's exactly what they did.
Props.
So yeah. Props.
Oh dude, that got me fired up. That's the thing, man. The knife industry, I love it. And I love when people are successful in it. And I love when a brand proves dated concepts wrong.
Yeah.
That to me is the most impressive thing that Montana Knife Company has done. Okay. It seems like they're building like a cool company culture that's true to them, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It seems like their customers are psyched on the product, which is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing it in a way that like the majority of the industry would have said won't work flat out.
Dude. Yeah. Yeah. Just inherently, just the fixed blades being that mass marketable was not believed to be true.
Dude, sick. Dude, I just got fired up.
Yeah.
I love it, man. I don't know. This all ties in, right? Like, cause if you look at like the conversation around modeling, right? Do someone's going to model after Montana?
Yeah.
And that's a really good model. And you know what it did? It broke down some barriers from old ways of thinking, from things that won't work, because now you have a thing where you can look at it and go, oh, that was really cool. I would change this. Or like, if I do this, this is how I would do it. But I see, but you're like leading the way in thought. And like, to me, for the knife industry, that's super valuable. Anything that comes in and can support our industry, even indirectly, just from like a kid picking up a magazine and seeing an ad that gets them stoked and seeing like, oh man, this company's rad. And like, look, the founders are hunting and like, I really like this product. And like, look at the dude, that to me is pretty amazing. Cause it's like you as a company, you have to have an attachment point. You have to have a place for someone to come in and care about what you do and care about the product. And it's easy at a custom level because we're dealing with human interaction, you know, customer to maker. That is the value, right? Like as companies scale, that proposition starts to change.
Yeah.
But dude, okay. So it's funny that probably reality is that they will be the next company. And there's a lot of steps between here and being, you know, any mass long-term running company. There's so many things that can go wrong or change, or a company can get valuable and sell to someone who doesn't foster it in the same way. But
yeah, it doesn't matter how big you get, you can fall off. And there's a stat, I forget the stat, but it's like the Fortune 500, which is not related to knives. It's the Fortune 500 list of biggest companies in the world. The turnover rate of those 500 is extremely high. I'd have to Google the stats exactly, but it's like, you would think, oh, well, if you're in the Fortune 500, you're a Fortune 500 company. Nobody can knock you off. Not true. They fall like rocks. Like there's so many of those that you'll look at today, look at it in 5 years. Like it's some high percentage will not be there anymore. And some of them won't even exist hardly at all. And it's like that there's a lot of tech companies and that's part of it, but you have to think about that. When you're building something big, is I've always said, build a pyramid, not a tower.
Yeah.
Because it's like structure that lasts. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You want stability. That's a pyramid. Pyramid stable, right?
Yeah.
I want balance, right? So when I look at what I'm building, it's really important for me to not actually take it to a point where my entire life is defending my position. Dude, I don't know why I keep coming in with like car metaphors, but you look at like F1 or something and you're like, every one of those dudes is actually the best kind of such a high level and they just are constantly trading.
Yeah.
It's like any given Sunday, like the concept, like any sport, doesn't matter how good you are. You're going to have a bad day, a bad year, a bad decision, a bad coach, manager, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you're balanced, those don't matter as much. If you just like racing cars and you're like, this is sick, I get to be in an F1 car.
Yeah.
Dude, this is awesome. All you have to do is just stay fast enough to like, you know, stay playing the game.
Yep.
If that's the goal.
Yeah. Long term, delivering consistency long term. Yeah. That's something I think a lot about.
Yeah.
Like Swiss Army. Yeah. Speaking of giant companies.
Yep.
Apparently, 150 years of people trying has not affected them much because they're still the biggest knife company in the world, as far as I know. And I just don't.
And dude, well, it's funny, right? So. I feel like this is like the closer, right? Because Swiss Army is actually just an awesome thing to just leave it at. But
yeah,
they're big enough that, dude, it's I don't even think most people think it's like not even a knife, man. Like it's not, no, you can be in any office, probably environment in the world and pull out a little Swiss Army knife and it is just fits in here. Yeah. I went to a shooting match a couple of weeks ago, dude, I see a lot of Benchmade clips.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That to me, that's like, that's where Swiss Army knife is. Like, dude, it's everywhere. It is just, and they are the biggest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quiet, right?
Yeah.
There's levels to this.
Yeah, nobody talks about Swiss Army knife. But
it's not the most exciting thing.
Yeah, but if you look up like Google, like knife clip art for my PowerPoint presentation, it's going to be a Swiss Army knife. It's like when people think of a knife, it's like a little red knife where it's got a little corkscrew. It's like almost to the point of it's a meme almost or a cliche.
Well, I've said that like one of the most interesting things to me is actually design that becomes so ubiquitous that it like almost just
transcends.
Yeah. So like, it's really funny, but now I'm going to forget the name of it. It's right on the tip of my tongue. Dude, what a waste. It's a steak knife, right? Mm. A lagule. It's a small steak knife. It was a folder, like a peasant folder. And then it became this form where some people are going to know the name lagule, but if you look that knife up, you're probably going to recognize it. That to me is one of the most interesting things because we forget. It's like something can just become so successful and so widespread that it disappears.
Yeah. It's so ubiquitous that you forget that it was ever designed.
Yeah. Everything is designed.
You forget it didn't just exist. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like a Swiss Army knife. Yeah. It was the biggest knife company.
Like someone sat down and pencil drew a Swiss Army knife. I was like, that's pretty cool. And he showed it to someone. They're like, I've never seen that before.
Well, the crazy that's thing crazy. About Swiss Army is like, you look at that and you're like, okay, here's my entire business model. I'm going to make an oval. Like,
with a bunch of pointy things.
With a bunch of pointy things. Is it actually an oval?
It's a pill shape.
It's a pill shape, right.
Yeah.
Ovoid?
Right?
Cigar shape?
Yeah.
Man, I don't know.
It's a tic-tac.
It's a tic-tac. I don't got book learning. Tic-tac. Okay. So takeaways from this episode. Hey, if somebody tells you that something's not going to work, maybe don't listen to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe you should, but like
filter all incoming advice.
Yeah.
Because most of it is wrong.
Probably including ours, but we're not giving direct advice.
Including ours.
Like at some point we're going to start doing things in a really dated way. The thing about that is for those companies, for those people, they're already at a point where that thing works. So when you're modeling, it's like you kind of look at steps that it took to get to a place and understanding that that place will change.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's going to change. It's going to, interesting brands at some point, for the most part, maybe stop doing the interesting thing because they are doing the stable thing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to this, but I don't know. Next big knife company. Let us know. Who do you guys think? What do you see? Do you see anything in the industry that leads?
Let's pretend this is a horse race. Where's the money?
Oh, dude.
Where's the money?
Okay. Time to start a pool.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny. What company crosses this financial line first?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you guys for listening. TJ, dude, that was a really fun one.
Yeah. I went totally different direction than I was picturing, but
I know
that was a great one.
We should have stayed on Blade West more probably. Have a great show, guys. Go see TJ at Blade West. Go hang out.
October 10, 11, I think.
Yeah. Go to a show.
Salt Lake City.
Yeah. It's good.
Thank you, guys.
Take it easy.
Peace.